as I've already said, I'm a differential geometer by trade. And one of the fundamental ideas in differential geometry is this idea called holonomy, or as some people who like to stick to the rules of English pronunciation pronounce it holonomy. But it's not something that you often hear about if you're not in differential geometry, and it's an important idea. It's an important subject concept that actually shows up in many, many ways in the world around us. And what I wanted to do today was talk a little bit about the idea, where it comes from, give you some examples, and give a hint of how it shows up in higher mathematics, in differential geometry. This isn't a talk for technicians in mathematics, so there's not going to be very much technical stuff. There will only be one or two equations, and they'll be very simple. But I hope to give you a flavor of the subject. But first, let me start out with an example of the kind of geometry I want to model. And that's the reason I wanted this hand card. Fortunately, MDMA was able to supply me with some props that I wasn't able to bring on the plane. And one of them is this hand card that I asked for. And what I want to talk about is how you mathematically model the motion of a hand card like this. I mean, the way you actually get the handcart to be where you want it to go is you move the handle somewhere. You move it around, and as you move the handle around, the wheels follow. But they don't follow just in the simplest way you can imagine, because, you know, if you pull over like this, the wheels move in a curve, not a straight line. And the question is, what is the relationship between the motion of the handle and the motion of the wheels? How do you actually steer a hand cart, if you think about it? And here's the calculus part of the lecture that I want to talk about. Let me just draw a schematic of the hand cart that I want to. For simplicity, I'm going to take the length of the tongue to be 1, and the position of the handle, let's call that AB, and the position of the midpoint, M, I'll call that XY, assume standard coordinates on the plane. And the thing you need to know, in order to know the position of the hand cart, is you need to know where the handle is and the angle that the segment from the midpoint of the axle to the handcart makes. That's the picture we want to keep in mind. And what you can think of is that the space of positions is parameterized by the coordinates of the handle and the angle theta. So it's a three-dimensional space that you're moving around in. A little 3 there. And the question is, how do you figure out how X and Y move when you do this? Well, the rule that tells you, that gives the constraint here, is that when you're moving the hand cart, it can move perpendicular to the axle, but it's very hard for it to move parallel to the axle. In fact, you can, to a first approximation, you could assume that there's no motion parallel to the axle. Right? So what it means is that if you're looking at the relation here, what you're saying is that the angle cosine theta sine theta has to be perpendicular to, in other words, the dot product. Am I going to do this right? X prime y prime. I want these to be parallel, right? I want x prime y prime to be some multiple of this vector, of the unit vector pointed in the theta direction. And another way to say that, when I write that as differential equations, is I want cosine theta y prime minus x prime sine theta to be 0. You can think of that as the differential equation of motion. But of course, what we're concerned with is the coordinates a, b, and theta, not so much x and y. So what we need to do is convert that into an equation relating a, b, and theta. And what's the relationship? That's easy to do, of course. What's the relationship between x, y, and a, b? I didn't promise it would be mathematics free.
Add cosine, theta, sine, theta.
Cosine, theta, sine, theta. Very good. And in fact, if we now substitute, if we now differentiate this and plug it in here.
What, subtract, right?
Sorry?
Subtract.
Actually, minus. You're absolutely right. Thank you. Good. Just trying to keep you on your toes. in fact, if we now differentiate this and subtract and plug it in here, then, and I'll make sure I get the sign right, you'll get that the equation you get is theta prime plus cosine theta a prime. Let me make sure I get the sign right. I'm always nervous about that. Sine theta a prime minus cosine theta b prime is 0. Sine theta. I think that's right. Let's see if I did this right. That's what I have here. I believe that's right. Because when you differentiate, of course, you know, the cosine, the derivative of minus cosine becomes plus sine theta, theta prime, and when you work it out, this is what you get. And the way we like to think about this, actually the time parameter doesn't tell you a whole lot about the relationship between A, B, and theta, because the time parameter is not so important. The way I like to think about this is, of course, writing this as, you know, velocity with respect to some parameter, and we differential geometers, since the parameter is irrelevant, we like to erase that. And what we get is this single relation, this differential relation, between the three variables, A, B, and theta, that describes the motion in this three-dimensional space. It gives us one equation relating, telling us what possible velocity vectors you can have in that three-dimensional space. And you can think of this as a differential equation saying, now if you know A and B, and you know the initial condition for theta at one point, this differential equation will tell you what theta is. It will tell you how theta moves. And in fact, you can sit down and work it out. It's a simple differential equation. It's nonlinear for theta as a function of A and B, but the nonlinear is not too bad, and I'll come back to that if I have time at the end. It's actually related to the Riccati equation. Interesting way. But those of you who do know some differential geometry will probably recognize this form. This so-called one form is what we call a contact form on this three-dimensional space, which is a subject now of very great interest in differential geometry and mechanics. Is studying three-dimensional spaces with a kind of equation like this, that a kind of one form that restricts motion in the space, and you want to try to understand, can you connect only two points? For example, if you're in one position in the hand cart, can you get to any other position just by moving the handle somewhere? That is, can you move freely in the space even though you're constrained in the direction? For hand carts, we certainly hope that's true. otherwise, we'll be in a bind, and hand carts wouldn't be nearly as useful as they are. That's one example of the kind of constrained motion I want to talk about, and the fact that even though at each point, you can sort of move in only two directions. Somehow or another, you want to be able to move in three. You want to be able to navigate in three, even though infinitesimally you can only move in two. And this is what holonomy is designed to help us understand, is how you can move in larger spaces than you actually have freedom to move in. infinitesimal freedom to move in. And I want to give another example. I've already mentioned I was at Duke for 20 years, and that may have influenced a little bit my choice of props. But let's consider another example of this kind of constrained motion, which is a ball rolling on a table without slipping or twisting. And this is going to be my example. The control that you have, so to speak, is how you push the ball. That is how you move the point of contact on a path along the plane. And what you want to understand is can I roll the ball from any point to any other point and have it wind up in a given orientation? Now, the set of possible orientations of the ball is fairly large, if you think about it. It's infinite because, you know, even fixing an axis of rotation is an infinite number of angles you could do. But that if you think of it in terms of parameters, there's really a three-parameter space, because there's a, you know, once you fix an axis for a rotation, you know, every rotation of the ball is a rotation around an axis. And once you fix an axis, which is basically choosing a point on the sphere, and that takes two parameters, and then you decide how far you're going to turn it, that's the third parameter. The set of rotations on the sphere, the set of rotations of the ball, is in fact a three-dimensional space. It's a nice three-dimensional space. And what we're trying to understand, if you think about it, the configurations of a ball, that is the positions of the ball, the position space here, better one here, the position space in this case is, again, going to be two coordinates, and I'll use the standard notation R2, cross the set of rotations of the ball. This is where the center touches, and the rotations of the ball, which is called rotations in three space in differential geometry. We use special orthogonal three dimensions. So that's what the standard SO3 notation means. And this is a three-dimensional space. This is two-dimensional. So the set of all positions is five-dimensional here. And what we actually have control over, just as over here, the thing we had control over is the position in the plane, the R2. The control space here, again, is the position in the plane where it's touching. And what we want to know is, with those two controls, can we actually fly around in this five-dimensional space freely? That is, can we, in any position, in any particular place, roll to another place and have it wind up in a given orientation that we want? And obviously, to do that, you're going to have to be kind of devious. I mean, if you just roll straight over, that's going to determine what the rotation is. But maybe by doing some kind of devious path, you can come around and wind up and have the ball wind up in the orientation you want, where you want. Now, there are lots of actual mechanical situations where you want to be able to solve this problem. Robot hands trying to pick up an object and roll it into position where it's supposed to be. It's a classic problem in control theory. And in fact, we're going to see how you can solve it and what the mechanism is. But the idea is that somehow or another, with only this two-dimensional freedom, infinitesimal two-dimensional freedom, we're still able to move in five dimensions. And that seems a little paradoxical, but in fact, it's an intimate part of the world we live in. Anybody that ever has ridden a bicycle, driven a car, done any of these kinds of mechanical systems has experienced this phenomenon of having more limited control than the motions you want to realize. And so we want to understand how to do this. Here are two examples where the controls are two-dimensional, the space you're working in is larger dimensions, and we want to understand how you move around. And not just abstractly understand how you do it, is it possible, but what's the best way to do it? Because, of course, for a machine that's trying to orient an object, you don't want it to waste a lot of time doing this. You want it to find a good solution. So maybe there's a shortest path you can roll over that'll get it into the position you want. And that's the kind of interesting question that comes up. Let me give another example, though, to show you that there's actually something to worry about. These are both cases, although I didn't write down the equations here. Those of you who study vector calculus can do it on your own without too much trouble. Again, it's the case where basically you have three differential equations governing the motion in the sort of internal space, the fiber, as we call it. And then you have three differential equations because of three extra parameters. Here we have only one differential equation because of only one parameter. But it's a constraint like that. The study of these kinds of constraints belongs to mechanics and differential equations. And I just want to point out that it's easy to write down conditions where you can't go everywhere. For example, suppose that you wanted to fly around in three space, but you put, again, one differential equation condition, you want always your position. So here we're going to fly around in three space. Here's x of t. And we're going to put on the condition that x of t, the position that the velocity vector should always be perpendicular to the position vector. So that's one equation. If you were, for example, in three dimensions, if you were writing this x, y, z, it would be xx dot plus yy dot plus dz dot is zero. It's one differential equation on three things, just like this is one differential equation on three things. But here, if you follow this rule, you cannot get everywhere. Why not?
You're going to stay on the sphere.
You have to stay on the unit sphere because this implies that xt dot xt is constant. Right? This is a differential equation that doesn't seem to have this kind of freedom, this differential equation. Same number of equations, same number of unknowns, but in this one you can move everywhere. And in this one you're forced to stick on a particular two-dimensional leaf. This phenomenon was observed already. It's pretty easy to see something like this happens as soon as you start writing down differential equations for motion. But it was finally given an explicit name in 1899 by a mechanician, Heinrich Hertz. In a book on mechanics, he described this kind of motion as opposed to this kind of motion. He called this holonomic motion. Now, where did this word come from? It's the combination of two Greek words, holo and nomos, which means this. There's no exact translation, but it's something like complete or exact. And this is something like rule. Rule, sometimes name, but in this particular case it means rule. And in this case, what he said was that this motion is holonomic because it implies an exact rule. A first integral, as we would call it now. Whereas this motion is what he called non-holonomic because it doesn't fix any rule relation between AD and theta when you move that way. So that's where the word comes from. And although there's a little bit of English is the way we've come down to it is a little bit perverse because now we say that this motion exhibits holonomy, and this motion exhibits holonomy, when we really ought to say it exhibits non-holonomy. And in fact, the failure of coming back exactly to where you started is called holonomy instead of non-holonomy. But that's what can you do? That's life. What I want to do is come back to this problem. And explain a little bit about how we understand the fact that we can move like this, but without doing the calculus part, I thought I'd look at a discrete version first, and we can look and see what some of these holonomy effects show up in the discrete version. And fortunately, I have a good approximation to the sphere, a nice approximation for the sphere. And see, one problem with me convincing you of anything with a basketball like this is it's very easy to cheat. Yeah. Right? I can claim that I got there and I can subtly turn things while it's rolling. But in the ideal world, it shouldn't slip and it shouldn't twist when it rolls. But I can easily do that while you're sitting there far away and can't see what I'm doing. So let me retire this for a moment and go to the discrete case where it's harder for me to cheat and easier for me to convince you of the right of what we're doing. And fortunately, I have Another aid to keep me from cheating is that I can put this on the grid, because when the thing rolls, you know, when a cube like this rolls, I've now made it completely discrete. I'm not liable to cheat you, or you can see me easily cheating, right? So this will keep me honest. Now the question is, what's the position space now? Obviously, where I place the cube, which square. So there's a tiling of the plane that I take into account. That's sort of my replacement for R2. But what's the replacement for the rotation group? What are the possible rotations of a cube?
The color of the side showing.
Sorry.
The color of the side showing.
The color of the side, although you have to be a little careful, because, for example, that's going to count as a rotation too.
Octahedral group. Octahedral group.
Octahedral group. Well, that's a, you're using the fact that the cube is dual to the octahedron. So it is the octahedral group, but that doesn't tell you a whole lot. For example, how big is it?
24.
There's 24 possible positions, and one way you can see that. What's the easiest way to see this? There's 24 possible positions. There's 6 faces that I can put down, and then once I put it down, there's 4 possible positions for it. Right? It's 24. Right? Now, it's a group. I don't know how many of you know what a group is. There might be some of you who don't. So I'll just say that, the rotation group, it's called a group because if you compose 2 rotations, you get another rotation. The inverse of a rotation is a rotation, and the identity is a rotation, and so forth. It's a way to multiply 2 things, and it satisfies the usual associative rules. It doesn't satisfy the commutative rule, but the associative rule it does. And in fact, this cube, 24 should ring a bell, right? 24 is not just some random number. It's also 4-factorial, and that suggests what? Permutations of 4 things, right? So it suggests that you should understand the cube as permutations of 4 things. You have to think a while. Obviously, it's 6 sides, so it's not permutations of 6 sides, although it is. It sits inside the permutations of 6 sides. You can't move all the 6 sides arbitrarily. But there is a set of 4 things that it acts on, and that's the opposite pairs of opposite vertices. There's 8 vertices, there's 4 pairs of opposite vertices, and a rotation is completely determined by how it permutes those 4 objects. So what we can say is that the position in this case is the tilings cross. In fact, it turns out it's the symmetric group on 4 letters. That is, it's in fact, it's not hard to show that you take any permutation of the 4 vertex pairs, there's exactly 1 rotation that will execute that pair. And so it is, in fact, the symmetric group on 4 letters, which has 24 elements. The question then is, can I, by starting here and tumbling, can I wind up anywhere I want to wind up and with any orientation I want to get? In other words, can I fly around freely in this space? Right? That's the question. Now, you might think, that's going to be hard to answer because there's lots of ways I can get here. Right? There's lots of paths I can go by. And how can I possibly test them all? Well, one way to reduce the problem is to ask yourself, how many ways can I get back to the origin? Because if I can get here with, say, 2 different rotations, then following one out and following the other back, I'll get the composed rotation here. And in fact, if I can get all rotations by coming in a loop, then that'll mean that, for example, if I want to get here with any desired rotation, all I have to do is follow the loop that rotates and gets it in the right position, and then just follow the standard path that'll get you there, and I can get wherever. It may not be the most efficient way to do it, but I could guarantee that I can get anywhere if, by following a loop, I can get back here and get any possible rotation. So that's the goal. Can we do that? And you might think, well, that yeah, that reduces the problem a little bit. Can I get any rotation by coming back to this point? But how does that help? Because every path is, because already the loops are still huge. That's a big thing. Well, the nice thing is that for loops, we can always break the loop up into what I'll call lassos. A lasso is a path like this that goes somewhere, goes around one vertex, and then goes back. So it goes out, goes around one vertex, and then comes back. That's what I'll call a lasso. And just a convention that you can really do this, for example, suppose I wanted to take this path and think of it as a lasso, as two lassos. The way I'd do it is I would take the path here, go back, that's one path, and then I'd undo this part. And that's a lasso, it just has no tail. So it turns out it's enough to know what the cube does when I go around the lasso. Because if I understand what all the permutations I can get by going around a single lasso, then I can compose those. I can look at the group they generate and see by just composing lassos. I mean, and the thing that makes this work is that a closed loop, like I said, a closed loop can always be decomposed into lassos, and following two lassos or any sequence of lassos just means you compose the rotations. All of this depends on the fact that the rotation you get by moving along a path and then reversing the path gives you the inverse rotation and things like that. So I'll let you work out all the you know, there's some little axioms you need to build in to make sure that you're not cheating, but it's not too bad. And so what really matters for us is what happens when we go around the lasso. And so, but that's easy. I mean, we've got only one lasso, really. Because the tails just undo themselves. So it's enough just to understand what happens when you do a lasso. And what happens when you do a lasso? If I, for example, start here, and the question is, what permutation was that? I probably will have to do that again.
It rotated around the diagonal, I think.
A diagonal of
the cube.
Of the cube, that's right. There's a fixed diagonal, that's good. That is a pair of opposite vertices that didn't move. Which are they?
The corner you rotated around.
The corner I rotated around didn't change, right? That stayed the same. But obviously, not everything stayed the same, right? So what's left so remember, this is supposed to be a permutation on four objects. It fixed one of them, and it didn't fix any of the other three. You can check that without too much trouble. That, you know, if you just think of the of that, for example, look at this vertex. If you do this, the fact that it didn't fix any one of them, it keeps the orientation the same, means that it just makes a three cycle of these three pairs of vertices. So what you get out of the lasso is what we call a three cycle. That is a permutation of three things fixing one. And that's sitting in a permutation of four things. Now, if you look at all of the three cycles, it's not hard to see what the three cycles are. So let's call these four things 1, 2, 3, 4. And we're going to consider permutations. For example, we'll leave one fixed, and we can cycle 2, 3, 4. So forth like that. This is a three cycle, and the next time we'll come back, of course. We can just cycle three. And if you look, so you always have this one fixed guy. But of course, if you take two of these, for example, if you do this and now cycle these three, say let's leave that and cycle this, you'll get 4-2-1-3, for example, cycling those three. That means corresponding fixing one of the other vertices. Right? And of course, that doesn't fix anything. 4-2-1-3 leaves no vertex fixed.
two.
But is it possible to get every permutation that way? By just applying three cycles, can I get every permutation? Any idea?
I think you lose the what do you call them? Flips. You lose the alternating, but the complement.
You get the alternating. Yeah. The alternating group means the even permutations. Right. Remember, a permutation is even if the number of odd cycles is even. And in this case, there's only two kinds of odd cycles: cycles of length one and cycles of length three. This has a cycle of length three. It's an even permutation. Oh, sorry. The number of even cycles is odd. That makes it odd. So the number of even cycles being even. Sorry. This is an even permutation. This is a composition of even permutations. It's also even. And in fact, because they're all made by three cycles, they're all even permutations. We'll never get into even permutations. And there's only 12 of those. The permutations divided into even and odd. So you can't get all 24. So there's actually a restriction on how you can move. You can't move freely in this space. You can only get half the things. And in fact, what we say in this case is the holonomy is the alternating group, A4, which is not all of S4. It actually has only 12 entries. So you can't get everywhere in this case using the cube. So this approximation might lead you to believe that maybe you can't get everywhere by rolling the sphere. That's only one approximation, though. Maybe it would be a good idea to take a little example. This is probably the simplest polyhedron that you could use to approximate the sphere. And here, fortunately, again, I have a way to keep myself from cheating. The idea here is can we roll the tetrahedron, tumble the tetrahedron around on this tiling by equilateral triangles and get anywhere? That is, get any orientation by doing this. That's the question. And given the story here, what would you expect? You need to check. Sorry?
Exactly what you found there. The number of odd permutations.
Ah, yeah. Now, we got to be a little careful about this. What's the symmetry group of the tetrahedron?
The alternating group that you've got.
It's in fact the alternating group.
Four.
The reason it's the alternating group, you know, it's permutations of four things. Now here there's obvious four things to permute, right? Which are the vertices, right? So that's pretty obvious. But it's not obvious that you can get every permutation. In fact, that is, by rotating this guy and so forth like this, maybe you can't get every possible permutation. And in fact, it's not hard to see why not. If you because of the phenomena of handedness. So here are two tetrahedra that are mirror images of each other. And obviously, maybe I should turn it this way. But there's no way to rotate this guy to get this guy. Right? So exactly because of the handedness. So in fact, you're not going to get every four permutations this way. But we can at least count how many there are, which is you're saying it's the alternating group, so it should be 12. What's the easy way to see that it should be 12? That's three ways to rotate it once you put down the face. Right. And in fact, it's 12 things acting on four objects. So it's got to sit in the permutation group. In fact, the only thing there can be in that case is the alternating group. So it has to be even permutations. And in fact, you can sort of see that. I mean, you fix one vertex, and then you can take a three-cycle on the other vertices, or you can fix the midpoints of opposite sides, and you can permute them two at a time. Mm-hmm. Or you can just leave them alone. And those are all the even permutations. So all you can get is the alternating group anyway. That's the most you could get. That's what the rotations are. And again, we've identified the position space. Position space in this case is this triangular lattice cross A4. This is our tetrahedron. And the question is, now how can we tell what happens? You know, what do we reduce to in order to test what possible subgroups are? We reduce to
loops.
To loops, right? We go down to loops, and the loops can be broken into lassos. And all we have to do is check the lasso that goes around one vertex. And that'll tell us what we need to know. Okay? So, let's do the experiment. Keep your eyes open. Red is down. Red is down. Does that tell us everything we need to know?
No.
We got to know one more thing. We got to know at least one more thing.
Tells us a lot.
It tells us a lot. It tells us a lot. One of the faces is fixed. So it's at most rotation around. It's at most a three cycle there. Right. But did anybody pay attention to where? So let's do it again. Pay attention. What?
Again.
Again? Again? Okay, I'll do it again. Return to the same orientation. In fact, rolling around in a loop does nothing.
Try a different version. Yeah.
There's a man who doesn't believe in singing. Rolling around in a loop does nothing. In fact, in this case, the whole anomaly is trivial. It's just the identity. So this is a case, this is more like Hertz's holonomic motion. There's no, there's an exact law that tells you it's going to be preserved when you come back to the origin. So, well, we know that's not a very good approximation to the sphere, because we know that when we roll the sphere around, we're not always going to come back to where we were. So that's not so good. Maybe we should try another approximation. Yeah. I happen to have a octahedron. Right? And we already know, somebody already said, the octahedral group is also
cube groups.
The cube group. That's right. It's the full rotation. It's the full permutations of four things. And in fact, those four things are now relatively easy to spot. I've colored them according to the four colors. Just pairs of opposite faces, because those correspond in the dual to the opposite vertices. So it's just pairs of opposite faces, and that's what we need to understand. And again, the story. I won't go through the whole. But again, it's a question of what happens when we do what?
When we go around the loop.
Right. So let's go around the loop now. You're gonna have to pay attention. So let's see what you come up with when I do this. Let's see. Red is down, so because red's on top. Green came on top, right? Let's do it again. But that may not have told you the whole story. The question is, what actually happened?
So two lasses.
Yeah, so twice around that vertex actually takes you back to where you were, and it switched red and green, and it switched blue and yellow. So if you're thinking of it, so here our position space again, for this is for the IQ. Position space is the lattice cross the S4, and we know that we can get, for example, something that exchanges two pairs. So we can get, say, like the cycle 1, 2, 3, 4, that is switch 1, 2, 3, 4. We know we can get that. But now let's see what happens. In this guy, we know that if we go around this guy, it'll switch red and green, call that 1 and 2, and blue and yellow, call that 3 and 4. What happens if we go around this guy? So watch. Red and yellow switch, and did you pay attention to what happened to blue and green? No. Okay. Let's record this. This is like 1, 3, 2, 4. And so I went around that one, I went around that one, I didn't go around this one. So let's go back to red. And now let's rotate around this guy.
Red and green switch.
And again, you'll have to check that blue and yellow switch. It's the same guy. But what happens if you switch 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and then switch positions? But maybe it'll be clearer if I do this. 1, 2, 3, 4. Let's switch 1 and 2, 3, 4, 3. And now what happens if we'll switch 1 and 3 and 2 and 4? That is, we'll switch 2 and 4. What happened in that case?
Reverse.
What does that correspond to?
Switching 1 and 4
to
3.
It's switching 1 and 4 to switching 2 and 3. In other words, switching in pairs. Mm-hmm. Right? And in fact, you'll see that if you compose any switches in pairs, you'll always do what? Two switches like that. That is two cycles. The product of two cycles is always what?
Identity.
It's either, well, not any two cycles. The product of a two cycle with itself is always the identity. But the product of two different two cycles, like this one to this one, is another two cycle, pair of two cycles, right? And in fact, there's only three pairs of two cycles, right? Because once you choose what goes with one, you're forced to know what the other two
right.
do.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, in fact, only four possible things that can happen. Nothing, switching 1 and 2 and then 3 and 4, switching 1 and 3 and 4 and 2, or switching 1 and 4 and 2 and 3. Those are the only things that happen. So you can get we call this group Z2 cross Z2. You can get a group of order 4, and it's called Z2 cross Z2 because it's two, the only group of order 4 is Z2 cross Z2. So the answer here, it's a group of order 4,
right?
There's also the cyclic group of order 4, but that would be an element of order 4, and there's not one in this set, because there's no 4 cycle. Sorry. So in fact, what you get here, the holonomy, is in this case, Z2 cross Z2, and the total order is 4. So that's a little better than 1.
But it's not 24.
12, 4. It's not clear where the pattern is going to go, right? not clear at all. Well, there's one more good approximation. And one of the reasons I chose this is the
icosahedron.
Now, the problem with the icosahedron in relation to polydrons, which is what these things are, is that polydrons only come in four colors. So I've invented a clear color. and made an icosahedron. Actually, I made two, and there's a reason I made two. You'll appreciate this. And I better be careful. Unfortunately, the clear color is not very stable. So things tend to, especially, and on top of that, here's an interesting thing. I don't know how many of you have ever had any experience with polyjoints. Of course, mainly kids play with them. They get fascinated by the bright colors and the geometry that you can do. But what's interesting is I always find in any set of polyjoints I've ever pulled with that the yellow ones are the ones that wear out the first. For some reason. So these things always tend to come apart on the yellow ones if I'm not careful. Anyway, it turns out there's actually, what's the group of the icosahedron? So the group of rotations that preserves an icosahedron.
The icosahedron. Yeah,
we know the name. How big is it?
60 elements.
There's 60 elements, and one way you can see that is 20 times 3 is 20 faces, and each face is a triangle, so there's three ways you can put it down.
Alternating group by 5 elements.
In fact, it is, although that's not so obvious. It's a group of order 60, but what 5 elements does it act on?
The 5 axes through the vertices.
Well, the axes through the vertices.
No, I'm sorry.
That's not a word.
No, that's not a word. You can put 5 tetrahedra inside of it.
You can. That's a little hard to see. Although the idea that
it's dual.
Yeah. If you look at its dual, you can. See, but still, it's not completely obvious what the 5 things are.
Both the duals have pentagons.
But that's each face the group doesn't preserve any given face, right? You got to have a set of 5 things that it acts on. And that's the, if you're going to realize it as the alternating group on 5 letters. And the idea is, in fact, that you can break it up, you can break the 20 faces up into 5 groups of 4 each. And that's why I colored it with 5 colors. Each, like the red faces, they're like the faces, their centers are the vertices of a tetrahedron. And green faces, their center are the vertices of a tetrahedron. So you can think of it as there's 5 tetrahedra sitting in here, or you can just think of it as the set of groups of these 4 element faces. And it, when you rotate, it takes each one of these things into its opposite. And it's not hard to see that, in fact, one way to see the alternating group is that as you turn this thing around, you get every possible even cyclic permutation of the 5 colors on the 12 vertices. Well, there's lots of ways you can understand it. So I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on that because I'm going to run out of time if I'm not careful. But I'm going to keep in mind that Ivar's gave me a long introduction, so I'm going to gain that time back. Unfortunately, there's no way I would have the polygon that would have been the size here would have been stable, especially with the clear faces. So I can't really do the experiment here. But what do you think the answer will be? I mean, the exact same picture is going to work. Again, we can reduce everything to lassos. We'll just figure out what's going to happen. And all you have to do is figure out what's going to happen when you rotate around these 3 guys. It's enough to know that, right? And the question is, well, what will happen? There's 60, I mean, can you get all 60 rotations by doing that, or do you have to do something else? Or do you get some proper subgroup? That's the question. You have to do a little experiment, and so I think I'm going to leave that for your homework. But it's an interesting question, and the interesting thing is that it turns out just from this argument you can show that whatever you do, any rotation that you can make by staying within this sort of roughly Superman kind of diagram. That is, you can get everything that you can reach just rolling inside just that area. It turns out. And the question is, can you get everything? Can you get all 60 of this stuff? Yes?
I have difficulties distinguishing the rotations of a particular triangle. The three rotations. They all look alike.
What do you mean? I mean, when I rotate, for example, the clear guy shows up on a different one every time I rotate.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Yeah.
So you have to use one of the other.
Yeah, you have to use all the colors, otherwise you can't tell what rotation you've got.
Right.
Because it's got to permute on five things.
Okay.
I mean, 60, that's too big to be permutations on anything smaller, four or three or two. It has to be at least five, and five works as even permutations on five things, and that's what you get. So that's the icosahedral story, and like I said, it's an interesting homework exercise. I don't want to leave you with nothing to do. I want to come back to the basketball. With that as sort of preparation, you can begin to see how you can answer the basketball question, without doing the calculus that's important for actually doing the applications and finding the most efficient way to do it, you can at least answer the question, can you rotate everywhere by rotating in a loop? Can you arrive anywhere you want to in any given orientation? With this as guide, you can see that all you have to do is figure out, can you get every rotation by doing a loop? So the set of loops in the plane somehow or another has to be mapped into the rotations. And the question is, does it fill out all the rotation space? And the key observation is this, just as we did over here, the key observation is that when you follow two different loops, what it does is multiply the rotations. So this, and of course you go reverse on a loop, it does the inverse rotation. So the set of rotations that you get is actually a subgroup of the set of all rotations. That's the first observation. And now it's just a question of figuring out what subgroup is it. What subgroup is it? Well, it's sitting in SO3, and there's one more thing about this subgroup that's important, and that is that the subgroup is what we call connected. That is, that if you can get any rotation, any particular rotation you can make, then you can find a path through the rotations that you make back to the identity, that is no rotation at all. And the reason you can do that is this. If you have some path, start here and wind some path, call this path gamma of t, say, here's your origin, you go along the path. If you scale that path by any parameter, so just shrink the path to the identity just by, say, making it half the size, which, of course, I'm not going to be able to draw this very well, but something like this. Just shrink everything down to the identity by, for example, putting a parameter s, 0 go from s down to 1. And if you look at the rotation that path induces, you'll see that as s goes to 0, the rotation continuously moves back to the identity. That's an exercise that you have to do to really prove it, but it's true. that because we can shrink paths, we can connect any rotation that we can get back to the identity. And now I have to pull a fact out of the hat about rotations in 3-space. Rotations in 3-space, it turns out there are not very many subgroups of the rotations in 3-space. There's either don't do anything, no rotation at all, that's a subgroup, is everything, and among the connected subgroups, the only thing that's left is rotation about a fixed axis. Once you fix an axis, all those rotations form a subgroup. That is, they're closed under composition and inverse. And the theorem is that those are the only connected subgroups of rotations. They're either trivial, the whole thing, or rotation about a fixed axis. It's not too hard to prove, but I don't think I'll spend time on it right now. And so that means the only question we have to answer is it rotation about a fixed axis? Because we know it's not trivial. And if we can show that it's not rotation about a fixed axis, then we know it's got to be everything. So now all we have to do is take two examples and show that they don't leave the same axis fixed. And that's easy to do if you just take, go around the square like we did. Let's take a lasso. You can compute that explicitly. Or go around another square like this. I'll let you check. You should experiment with basketball. And those two rotations are not about the same axis. So that means it can't be rotation about a fixed axis, so it must be everything. So it must be possible to get from any point to any other point by rotation, by following the path, by choosing the right path. That's the result. Now, that works really well in this particular case, for the basketball rotation. There are a lot more cases, in the real world, you're often not rolling on a plane, your mechanical system, the surface is curved, this guy's not a perfect sphere, there's all kinds of things that you have to take into account. But there's a theory of these non-holonomic motions that allows us to actually do calculus with these things and not only determine whether or not you can move freely in a holonomically constrained space, or not only determine whether you can move freely, it also you can figure out how you can do it most efficiently. And that's, of course, important in applications. But the thing that I want to beyond sort of the everyday applications of holonomy, this idea of how motion constraints still gives you freedom in auxiliary variables, this actually shows up very much in physics. The most famous example of this is in Einstein's theory of general theory of relativity. If you take an inertial guidance system, for example, which we now have these very, very high precision inertial guidance systems, and fly it around, say, around the Earth, or take it up in a plane and bring it back down and compare it, you'll find that the inertial guidance system has rotated. And it's not because there's something wrong with it mechanically, it's because the space that it's moving through is curved. And in fact, holonomy actually is a measure. This was begun to be understood in about the 1920s, that this failure of inertial guidance tracking was exactly a way to measure the curvature of space. And all these things we call tidal forces and stuff like that are manifestations of holonomy in general relativity. Well, it goes far beyond that now in particle physics and string theory and now M theory, these higher dimensional theories. It turns out that all of these have exactly this kind of property, that there's a control space, there's a position space called the principal bundle, and this kind of connection that tells you how you lift paths down here to paths up in space. And understand, and the times when the holonomy turns out not to be everything, that is when we get what we call special or restricted holonomy, turn out to be the times when there's something special happening, some extra symmetry, some extra integrability in the equations that people didn't expect. This is, in fact, where supersymmetry comes from. This is the existence of parallel spinners and things like that. Which is how I got connected with it in the study of manifolds of special holonomy in dimensions 7 and 8 a long time ago. But in fact, in all of these cases, the cases where holonomy is not as large as you would expect generically, it always means that there's some extra symmetry, some extra conservation law, some extra property that helps you understand the system. And this is why people are so excited about string theory and M theory, because they have this extra symmetry that allows them to make predictions and do calculations that otherwise the theory would be so complicated they couldn't do. And so the study of holonomy, the study of things that are special holonomy, has turned out to be a major industry now in high energy particle physics and relativity. And in fact, it's told us, it's allowed physicists to make predictions about purely mathematical things that mathematicians have spent the last 20, 30 years now working out how can we prove those things. And we haven't done it. We haven't completed it yet. It's still a huge project there. It has implications in number theory, implications in algebraic geometry, in differential geometry, just amazing predictions that the physicists make that mathematicians scratch their head and say, how do you know that? Well, we're on our way. And so with that, I think I'll stop.